Hello, this is the Love Letter Squad. I'm Teresa Ayers.
And I'm Janet Gallen, and we welcome you to today's presentation of a wonderful love story, and I'm already enthusiastic about it because I happen to know this love story. I met this wonderful man at a dinner party, and as he was talking about his wife, I thought, you know, this is a story that really the whole world should hear. So I asked Jack Halpern, who is our guest today, to come tell us this story. It is so inspiring. It is so instructive in so many ways. And to see this exceptionally handsome man smiling at the thought of his wife. And by the way, one of the things he said, he looked at her picture and was in a burst of such loving enthusiasm and with such a smile said, if she were alive today, she'd be 102. And I thought, well, here's a story definitely worth telling. She was gorgeous, I can tell you from that picture. So I want to introduce Jack Halpern, who has done many things in life, and I hope he will tell us about as many as he can. He was in the Navy, and at some point in his life, he started collecting minerals and has one of the most important mineral collections in, what, the country? Would you say?
That's good of you to say. Thank you.
Oh, it's exceptional. It's exceptional. And he's also a gardener and just won top prize in a rose show. Isn't that right?
That's correct.
Yes. So, Jack, I want to just go right to you. And will you tell us the story? If you want to tell us a little bit about your mineral collection, just briefly, and your flowers, and start with that. That might be nice to know about.
I'll start with the way I met my wife.
Perfect.
It was very early in World War II. It was 1942. Pearl Harbor had just been bombed, and I joined the Navy. And I was sent to radar school at Treasure Island in San Francisco Bay for a six-month course. And on the very first liberty, when I could leave the island to get into San Francisco, I did, and I went to the USO, which is a United Service Organization, a civilian organization run to welcome service people, to make them feel comfortable and happy, and give them a cup of coffee and a smile and maybe a sandwich. And we asked the hostess, what's doing in town? She said, well, it's a Sunday afternoon, and it's wartime, so there's very little doing, actually, except that at a place called Stern Grove, a eucalyptus grove in San Francisco, there's to be a symphony concert with the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra performing. And she looked around and she said, and there's a lady who's offered to drive servicemen to the concert. And she beckoned that lady to come over and introduced her to my friends and me. And it was a happy meeting. And we got into her car and she drove us to Stern Grove. And she was using special, precious gasoline, which was rationed at that time. And she was using some of her allotment of gasoline for a warm purpose of making servicemen feel happy and comfortable.
So a really giving person.
A giving person. Mm-hmm. And that was you're right about that, because that was a good adjective, giving, to describe the way she has been for the rest of our time together. We went to the grove and sat down, and the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra performed beautiful music, conducted by Pierre Monteux, one of the top conductors of the day. And after the concert was over, she said, would you like to see more of San Francisco area? And we said eagerly, yes. And she drove us down to Palo Alto to Stanford University campus and drove us through the campus and showed us the sights there. And then we invited her to dinner at a little restaurant on El Camino Real in Palo Alto. And we were three guys and one gal. Mm-hmm. And we hit it off. It was magical. We got along just beautifully, as though we'd been friends forever.
So you mean nice. All four of you, or just you and this lovely woman?
It was actually two of my buddies, counting me, it was three of us, and Leslie.
So all four of you got along, is what
four
you,
of us all got along beautifully, purposely, perfectly. Mm-hmm. And when the day came to an end, she drove us back to the ferry building, where we were going to get the bus to take us back to Treasure Island. And one of the fellows said, say, we thought that there were such things as big trees in California, and we hadn't seen those. And she said, well, it's a wonderful place called Muir Woods over the Golden Gate Bridge. Have you ever been over the bridge? And we said, no, we had not even seen the bridge. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, when do you have liberty again? And we had liberty 2 weekends hence. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, my sister and I will make a picnic, and we'll pick you up here at the ferry building 2 Sundays from now at 11 o'clock in the morning, and we'll drive you over the Golden Gate Bridge to Muir Woods, and we'll have a picnic, and you'll see the big trees. And so that came to pass. And as soon as we got over to Muir Woods, I climbed up on a log and was looking at the big trees, and I walked over the side of the log, which was elevated about 10 feet above the ground at that point. And I walked over the side inadvertently, stupidly, and I fell. And I put my hands out to break the fall, and instead of merely breaking the fall, I broke both of my wrists.
Oh, my.
And they ached for quite a bit, and then they must have become numb.
Mm-hmm.
And Leslie, seeing my distress, looked around, and she saw a doctor that she recognized from San Francisco who happened to be vacationing at Muir Woods that same day. And she beckoned him over to inspect my wrists. He said, I think this one's broken. Then he examined the other. I think this one's broken, too. You've got 2 broken wrists. And you'll have to be set into plaster casts, and you'll be disabled for a month or so. And my buddy said, well, we haven't had our picnic yet. Do we have to go right back to the base?
Oh, here, Jack's interrupting a good meal.
Yeah, exactly. The doctor said, I don't think an hour or two one way or the other is going to make any difference.
Oh.
And so Leslie had to feed me my picnic, which was a very intimate kind of gesture. And at the end of the picnic, we drove back to the base, and I was disabled for a couple of weeks. And Leslie opened her home to me, where she lived with her mother mm-hmm. and her sister.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a garden. I was very interested in the garden. And she and I started to go together. And on weekends, when I was free to leave the island to go into San Francisco, we would have times together. And I can remember one time she said, let's go to Bay Bridge mm-hmm. to a place called Hanky Dink, which is what became Trader Vic.
Oh.
It was his first place in Emeryville. And I said, I haven't got any money. I haven't got enough money to go to that. And she reached into her pocket and took out a $20 bill and gave it to me. And I was absolutely aghast. The idea of taking money from a woman was just an impossible thing for me. And she didn't desist. She took the bill and put it into my pocket in spite of my objections. And I got over it. And we had a wonderful time at Hinky Dink. And have had a wonderful time ever since then. When
So at what point, where was the proposal here?
The proposal, when I graduated from this radar class, mm-hmm. I was sent to Naval Training School, MIT,
mm-hmm.
in Cambridge, Massachusetts, mm-hmm. where a brilliant system of navigation called LORAN, LORAN, an acronym for Long Range Navigation, had been developed.
Mm-hmm.
And I was to learn the system, which was secret at that time, the top level of security, secret, and teach it to the navigating personnel of the Navy. And when I was told that I would be there for at least a year teaching,
mm-hmm.
I reflected on my experience with Leslie in San Francisco, and I wrote a letter of proposal of marriage to her.
So a letter did it.
A letter did it.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a woman more than half again older than I was.
Yeah.
I was 22. She was 35.
Now, that was unusual for that day.
I guess it was.
Mm-hmm.
And but the difference of our ages didn't make one particle of difference in our lives
mm-hmm.
that ensued in the following mm-hmm. years.
So she said yes.
She must have thought for a long time, mm-hmm. and she, from what I learned later, she consulted a number of her friends, should she go ahead with this strange union? And they said, go for it.
Oh,
and
good.
She went for it. Mm-hmm. And she had to take the train east because there were no commercial planes flying during the war.
Mm-hmm.
And she came to Brooklyn, where my family lived, and we were married there.
Mm-hmm.
And then back to the Boston area where I was teaching.
Now, was your family at all disturbed that you were marrying a woman so much older?
Yes, my mother was aghast that
uh-huh.
I was marrying
aghast,
a woman that
more than
older,
disturbed, yeah.
Because she thought I would never have children.
Oh.
And she was incorrect at
of
that.
Course.
We had two lovely daughters
yes.
who are now among my closest friends
yes.
and who are very good to me. And so it was kind of like a fairy story, the
really?
whole life.
So what was your life? I know that she was really... What rank were you in the Navy? Did you reach something really...
I was seaman second class when I entered the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was promoted over the years. So I'm a lieutenant commander, retired now.
That's impressive.
Thank you for saying that. It's impressive.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an example of the good fortune that has smiled on me throughout my entire life and is continuing today in this interview.
Oh, yes. Well, forgive me, but I have to say that breaking your wrists was in fact a very lucky break for you.
How right you are. You've got the right slant on
but
the word
break.
But
you know, also, when you talk about good fortune, I always have to smile when I hear people like you talk about good fortune because you bring so much to the world that somehow some people are just really fortunate in what they attract. And the awarenesses they have, and you, the way you talk about your wife and her skills. Talk about her after you were married and how she was at work and financially, and I know she was very smart.
She was extremely, extremely bright. I was earning, I think, $29 a month in the Navy. That was mm-hmm. the Navy pay for the lowest rating when I first...
Well, no wonder that $20 then seemed like a fortune to you.
Absolutely. That's why it did.
What was she working? How did she earn?
She was a working girl. She was a secretary in an advertising agency. And she did all the banking for us. And she would say to me, I remember she said to me, Jack, we have about $450 more in the bank than we need for our family. Pick out some blue chip stock that's been paying dividends for, she paused for a moment, then she continued, at least 50 years. And then she said, make that 100 years. I want a record of stability before we invest any of our hard-earned dough. And so I would pick a company like AT&T, which was one of the top companies of the day. And we would buy how many shares for $400 mm-hmm. would buy us of AT&T stock. And maybe... 8 months, 10 months later, she would say, Jack, we have another $600 more in the bank than we need. She was earning money herself mm-hmm. as a working girl, too. And so she said, pick out a stock. And I said, we can buy more of that AT&T. And she said, no, we shouldn't have too many eggs in one basket. She said, let's diversify. And so I pick out a company like 3M, Minnesota mm-hmm. Mining Company, which was one of the top companies of the day and still is.
Mm-hmm.
And we would buy however many shares, a few hundred dollars would buy us of that. And so over the years it went, investing small amounts of money in blue chip stocks.
And you lived modestly, right?
We lived very modestly, mm-hmm. but very happily.
Mm-hmm.
And we had two daughters. And continuing on the monetary aspect, she never believed in selling any of the stocks when they went up to achieve the gain. She believed in holding them for the security that stock ownership represented and for the thing that we would have when we needed a new refrigerator
mm-hmm.
or a new car. And so she would sell the stocks only to finance those kinds of purchases. And so by the time her life came to an end in 1995, we had maybe 40 or 50 different stocks. Which we
for all those little $450 and $600
exactly,
inputs.
Less than $1,000 in each stock.
Uh-huh.
And yet, those stocks were worth, each of them was worth $60,000, $70,000, $100,000, simply by the gain in value that blue chips had made over mm-hmm. that particular era.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, I had discovered the world of mineral crystals, which are beautiful, mm-hmm. beautiful things. and attracted my inner guy so that I began to collect them. And I built up a sizable collection of beautiful mineral crystals. And she never believed in my parting with our money mm-hmm. to buy these crystals. But after, when we were quite a while long in life, her sister, her younger sister, died. And much to our amazement, left a large fortune, 40% to each of my two daughters, mm-hmm. and the remaining 20% to the Smithsonian Institution in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
So each of my girls inherited over $1 million in mm-hmm. blue chip stocks, unexpectedly, out of a clear sky.
Mm-hmm.
And
makes you wonder why saving isn't more popular.
We've just gotten out of the habit.
Yeah.
And I think the world would not be in the economic disaster situation in which it now is.
Thank you. I'm glad you said it. I was not wanting to. Yeah.
If everyone lived the way my life's precepts
yes,
led her
exactly.
to live and led
mm-hmm.
me to live,
mm-hmm.
because she believed never borrowing, never owing any money, always paying your bills surely by the end of the month, never buying anything that you didn't have the ready money to pay for,
mm-hmm.
and that you paid for it when you acquired it.
Right.
But after my girls inherited this money, and after my wife died, I felt free then to transfer some of the money from the stock ownership into mineral specimens, which
mm-hmm.
a number of them cost considerable amounts of money.
And it's a value. It's a valuable thing in its own right.
Yeah, the collection is worth about $5 million mm-hmm. today, made up of purchases that were modest at the time,
right.
but which have grown over the years. And so people from all over the world phone me from Berlin or from Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
They're coming to San Francisco. Could they come to see the collection? And I'm delighted. And I open the door and open my arms to greet them. And
yeah.
so...
I was privileged enough to see it, and I was just stunned. Whatever I thought it would be, it was not. It was more. It's just exceptional. And your very meticulous habit, and I can see you've lived kind of a meticulous life, your habit of coding each one with a little, you know, you have color-coded dots, and then each one has a name and a file, so...
From the back of the specimen, mm-hmm. the part's not going to be on display. I paint a white spot with typewriter correction fluid, and then when that dries, and it dries in half a minute or so,
mm-hmm.
I write a number
mm-hmm.
there to identify the number unique number that I give to that particular specimen. So each specimen has its own number and is cataloged accordingly. And so I'm up to about 3,700.
Yes.
And so I've got a sizable collection.
And you've welcomed school children into your basement.
Every year, the school children of San Francisco are sent to my home to see the mineral collection.
Mm.
And it delights me to see the eagerness with which they observe the specimens. And I give each one of them a crystal to take home with an identifying label for what it is and where it came from.
It's so nice.
And encourage them, in case they're interested, to start their own collections. And who knows what lives may have been sparked by such a gesture.
And your wife, I gather from the pictures, was a very beautiful woman.
I thought she was beautiful and lovely.
Yes.
And the beauty lay well beneath the surface.
Oh, I'm sure.
And the common sense that she had
far
exceeded the common sense that I had or still have.
And so you're grateful to her extra... I can see that you're still grateful to her extra talents and abilities and qualities that brought you farther along in life.
You're hitting the nail precisely on the head. She made my life.
I've heard you say that.
Yeah.
I've heard you
and
say
continues
that.
At this late stage of my life to make it, because the precepts that she gave me govern my behavior still. I learn from her.
Okay, so I was just going to say that. I'm so glad you did, because it seems to me what I'm hearing is that here's a woman you met who took care of you from the beginning. She was good to you. She took care of you. She was giving to you. She took you out. She took care of you when your wrists were broken. She took care of you in so many ways, and I know you took care of her in so many ways also. but as we're talking about the way she did, and then her very behavior and financial responsibility and strength and passion for you, now that she's not here, you still have that strength and financial security. And in other words, she started out caring enough about you to look after you, and somehow she still is.
She did precisely what you say. In the short time that you and I know one another, Janet, I'm amazed at the depth of your perception of reality.
Well, you make it so clear.
That's good.
I must say.
I can tell one anecdote if we have time for
Please,
it.
Please, yes.
I had just retired from my job. I was 62. And shortly after I retired, I was diagnosed with stomach cancer, which was a life-ending diagnosis. I was told there was no chance for survival. Jack, get your affairs in order. And I was at Letterman Hospital, which was the military hospital in San Francisco Bay, to which I was entitled through my service in the Navy during the war and in my time in the Naval Reserve after the war. And so just before I was to have surgery, Leslie, my wife, came to see me. And I had gone to the hospital library and taken out a book on cancer and turned to the chapter on stomach cancer and narrated to her what I had read. Because it had said, fortunately, this disease is becoming less common in the United States. But unfortunately, only one person in seven is alive 1 year after diagnosis of stomach cancer. And I made the mistake of telling that to my wife. I should never have given her that burden. Instead of wilting under my statement, she put her arm around my shoulder and said, Jack, I don't care if it's one in 77, you are the one. And I realized somebody had to be the one, and she made me smile instead of being sad. Yes. And I recovered from the stomach cancer. They took out my stomach. I don't have a stomach now. And I had no idea one could get along without a stomach, but you can. And who knows, but the length of my survival in life may have been due to the fact that I don't have a stomach.
Oh, that could be. But I have a question to ask you, as we just have a couple of more minutes here, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as we are about love letters, and I know that fact that you proposed in a letter certainly counts and should be enough for us. But do you write letters to your daughters?
Yes, I write to my daughters.
Do you? Okay.
I, as a matter of fact, I've written one to my daughter who's helping me tremendously. My 90th birthday is coming up in a week or so. And there's to be a big party in my house that my daughters have planned and have gone to the extent that I would never have dreamed in order to make that party a gala, happy event for all that come.
Well, what I was wondering is, this story is so wonderful, this whole love story and all that you've learned from your wife and what you see in her and what your life was because of her and because of you. I was just wondering, would you ever consider writing it all down in your own handwriting? I mean, it may be a few pages and it would take some time. And sending it as a love letter to your daughters, as in, dear, and their names, because you are the children of the woman I loved all my life. I want you to have this story from me, so it will be here forever.
Janet, you make me sob just to think of such a thing.
Would you do that?
I would do such a thing, and I would, with your guidance and your encouragement.
I'd be happy to.
I will do
because
it.
Because this is your history. And someday, somebody's going to find this in another four generations, because we still have that thing signed by John Hancock, perfectly legible.
Yes.
And somebody is going to know. You have grandchildren.
I do have one granddaughter who's 36.
So she's maybe having children someday. She'll have friends. She'll have cousins. Somebody in your family, generations from now, will find this, and they will know something incredibly important about their pedigree. That is you and your wife.
That's a brilliant and a noble idea.
Okay. So you go home with some homework?
I hope that I follow through with your suggestion and record.
Yeah. In your own handwriting.
In my own handwriting.
Yes.
Because I don't use a computer.
Right. Oh, good. And on some stationery that's nice and, you know, sturdy, so it'll last forever.
Thank you.
And indelible ink, because you don't want spilled coffee or wine to flush it away.
You're thinking about centuries from now, somebody may come across this account and say, look what happened to this guy.
Somebody will.
Yeah.
It'll be in some drawer. People come across letters all the time. So why not leave a trail of the real you?
And Janet, you're the one who's encouraged me to do this.
Okay.
And I thank you for planting the thought in my mind.
I'm glad.
I shall execute it.
Perfect. Thank you.
And that's what we're all about. You also will have a copy of this recording, but as we know, technology changes and, you know, 100 years from now, nobody will be able to play it.
100 years from now, this CD will be a doorstop.
Yes.
But right. The letter on paper in your own handwriting will survive.
Really. Thank you so much for coming to tell us this story again. And even though I heard it once before, I'm smiling like I've never heard it before.
Thank you, Janet, for inviting me to share this love story. And it truly is a love story.
Really.
And I hope that for each of the people who may hear this narration, that you have as much greatness and good and joy in your life, together with the sadness that enters into the life of each of us.
Right.
As I have had.
Thank you.
How many years were you married?
Was married for about 53 years. And it's been about 26 or 27 years since my wife died. But she,
She's still hearing you.
She didn't die. She's
right.
with me every day,
obviously.
Every night,
yes.
All the time.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. It's truly lovely.
We're going to be smiling all day.
Yes, absolutely. So, and we thank our listeners for joining us and hope that you'll join us every week at this time. We're here. And please send us your thoughts to our email if it suits you. Let us know what you think. Our address is info@loveLetterSquad.com.
Thank you.
You can visit our website.
Please visit our website at www.loveletters.com. Loveletterssquad.com. And remember that whatever best self you put on paper today will be somebody's joy to find in generations to come.
Right.
And will probably be your joy to find even in another 10 years and reread what you felt.
Right.
And date the letters so everyone will know the time at which you were loved.
Right. So for now, again, we encourage you to put your loving thoughts into words, put them on paper, and send them while you still have the chance.
Yes. Thank you, and we look forward to seeing you next week.
Okay, till then.
Bye.
Bye.